Mr. Lister, Real Six. We were talking about when the cinema was bombed, and you were describing the scene beforehand, so to speak.
Yes, it was a Saturday lunchtime. I should think it would be somewhere around about 12:30 p.m. because that Saturday was the only day that an afternoon film there, and then two shows at night, and I can't remember what the film was that it was on that particular week, but there was a full week feature the following week, believe it or not, it can be checked, was Gone with the Wind, Scarlett, you know, and the manager used to change the posters and things. It was only a small thing itself, and the captions over the foyer outside, he used to get the ladders and change them every time they changed the show, and the cashier used to come. It was sort of a clockwork thing, you could rely on them almost. She came first and opened the little office door, which was not actually necessary to go into the cinema proper, and went in there and did whatever she did. That was like a brick part lean-to actually built onto the cinema on the left facing. And then the manager came along and opened the grill and went into the cinema and came out with these ladders and started to change things over. And then he went inside again for something, and we could see this female was doing something. It was like a house window, you know, doing something in the office, and suddenly there was this terrific roar and cannon fire. And we'd moved slightly away from the window, by pure coincidence, towards the wall, and had a premonition, and I grabbed this jock and banged him down into the gutter, and we tried to get as close to the earth as I possibly could, and hope that they had the sense to do so. And the bomb dropped on the bomb dropped on the cinema, virtually dead centre apparently, and the whole thing just disintegrated. And there was bricks and mortar and glass and God knows what flying and showering down around us, and miraculous, neither of us got a mark, and neither did the bloke in the in the garage, and it didn't even break the glass in the garage window. It was truly fantastic. But of course, as soon as it had gone, it jumped on his feet, and so did the other fella. And tell you, pretty shaken, I can tell you. But all I could see was a leg sticking out of the ruins on the opposite side. So we shot across, and by then a few more blokes that had been in the garage came out, and we started to chip debris and stuff away to try and get in, you know, reasonably carefully. And I think we were working on it for about 5 or 6 minutes, and then the ARP people came and chased us out of it, and local cop had dug himself out from somewhere and came along to punch all the people about them. So we still, and affected me very much, because although I'd experienced machine gun rifle fire before, I'd never actually being in such close contact with a bomb, and I was thinking, I was shaking for days, you know.
Was the woman all right?
No, they were both dead. They never found him, anyhow. They found the remnants of
her. That would be her leg, would it?
Yeah. I'm not too sure. I don't like to contemplate as to whether it was still attached to the rest of her, but it seems hardly likely when you think about it, because it was absolutely shattered. The place was devastated. As I say, it was only a small place, but it was brick with an asbestos roof, I think, and you can really imagine that.
Now, you said your nerves were gone a bit. I mean, did that make you worry about when you actually went into action how bad it would be?
No,
I mean,
I've really forgotten about it by now. It just lasted. It was a sort of a 48-hour thing. I thought I was never going to feel right again, but it went on. But it was the most amusing incident. Occurred a couple of days later, again. A fox wolf on the vicar. At the church was an extremely nice man. His wife was a nice woman, and they lived in the vicarage on the high side of Rye itself, overlooking the old port as it was, which of course dried up then. But they lived in the end house on the top of this, and there was a pub on the corner below their garden opposite, called the Bluebell, and he used to go in there, and he enjoyed the fight and a bit of a talk to the locals, and he was very good with the soldiers, and he was in there on this particular lunchtime. And one of these hit and run fox wolves came, and the vicarage disappeared. And of course,
hit by a bomb.
Yeah, as soon as it had gone, as soon as the plane had flown across, everybody rushed out. And the whole of it, the front of it and the end of the house was blown away, and it was just part of the upper storage left, floor hanging at grotesque angles. And the bath was attached to pipes on the wall, and it was tilted, and the vicar's wife was in the bath. And she was shouting her head off, obviously not damaged in any way, and the vicar says, "Good God, I'll have to have a word with her." He said, "This is most unseemly conduct." It's a tremendous sense of humour. And this is the sort of thing that he used to say, but I mean, he made it like something that was quite a serious matter, and she was very nice about it when she finally got herself sorted out. A lot of these people were, I suppose, were quite used to this sort of thing happening, and they adapted to it. Whereas a lot of people didn't. There's just a difference, but there's a tremendous amount. But there's most of them seem to come to. I'll have to have a word with them about it. I've got to have a word.
What about now? One thing in the history, it mentions that a dance band was set up by the battalion.
Yeah, they did have a dance band.
Do you remember much about the sort of do's they'd have?
No, it's just I don't think it was a particularly good band, but they made a noise, and it was acceptable. We used to have dances in where they could, like in village halls or whatever, the local girls used to lap them up. But that more or less continued one way and another with the battalion for quite a long time, because
You were there until, I think, until October, but there's two things. Well, there was, in August, there was a long exercise where they were sort of marched 150 miles, you know. Now, you were in the MT. Would that affect you like that? Because it jokes that the popular remark was, who said we were mechanised?
I was on an advanced fitness course in Brighton at the time. Couldn't have happened at a better time as far as I was concerned.
So you missed that.
Yeah.
What was the that? Now you'd done the fitters one in Leeds, I think it was.
Yeah, right.
This was the next one on, was it?
Yeah.
And what was there to learn, if you see what I mean? What were they trying to get into you this time?
Well, it was a bit disappointing as far as work was concerned, because you were more or less just repeating what you'd already done. I thought it was a bit of a waste of time. And I didn't put a lot of effort into it, and I didn't get very good marks. But Lisa could got me a grade further.
Right.
I think, I don't know, I forget how much it was a day.
What, now, Murray left and was replaced by Colonel Ware.
That's
what had Murray been like? Had he had an impact on the battalion, do you think?
Oh, he did. He was a very positive and forceful sort of fellow, and he had a job to do, and he was determined to do it. And he was pretty well successful, you know.
Was he popular?
Yes, I think so. I never heard anybody on any particular criticism.
Would you come into contact with him? I mean, did they really have an influence on the whole battalion, or?
Well, he was more. He was possibly more aloof, coming from what they consider to be a more elite.
He wasn't a Durham man.
No, he was a guards, yeah, brigade of guards officer. Not sure, was it? Grenadiers, I think. He didn't. Well, saved by me before he was a Durham man, like he was the officer.
He was the one before.
And as far as I can remember, Ware was as well. I think he was.
What was Ware like?
Well, he was acceptable. I can say that about him, but he didn't seem to me to have a sense of direction that his predecessor had. He never seemed to know what he wanted.
Now, in October, you got news that you were about to leave.
That's right.
For North Africa. Mm-hmm. How did you feel when you got the news? The news of the posting.
I was quite pleased to it myself. I thought it was about time and it got somewhere.
And did you get a embarkation leave?
Yeah.
And how did you spend it?
Largely. Not having much else to do.
What preparations did you have to make, especially in your section, the MT section, for going overseas?
Well, a lot of the transport was taken off us altogether, and just cut down to the central, and you pick fresh fingers up when you got to North Africa, in some cases.
What did you actually take with you then?
Well, I took all the QM stuff and all the office, you know, PHQ stuff and things like that. And all the kit bags, and they took quite a lot of space up. But a lot of us, as I said, a lot of us had to travel by train.
What do you remember about the journey out?
I remember the seeing a particularly bad time to be gone, Christmas time, but I remember the little destroyer going past, which was all a Merry Christmas festival and displayed some banner strips on the side. Merry Christmas to you all. And then we disappeared into the blue. It wasn't a very good ship we were on.
Do you remember its name? Because, as you say, you actually left on Christmas Day from Liverpool.
Yeah. It was a Stafford ship.
What was wrong with it?
It was... It was old and it wasn't as clean as it might have been, and despite denials by the captain and various others, there was oil getting in the bilge somewhere, and the lower down you got in the ship, depending on which deck you were, the more the stench was, and it didn't do anybody any good. It was oily stench all the time. They said it wasn't there, so if they say it's not there, it's not there.
Where were you put on the ship? Was it a proper troop deck?
Yeah, I was on 1, 2, 3, the third one down, there was 4.
And what space did you have? How were you put?
We had hammocks.
How did you manage with them?
Well, I haven't used one before. I managed all right, but it was a pantomime. And some of them just didn't move, they just laid on the floor because I couldn't get in. And there was tables, trestle type tables, fastened to the deck, and benches likewise, on either side. And your meals or whatever.
What was the food like aboard?
Well, depends on your state of your stomach. I managed it very well. I'm used to get tinned bacon and things like that, and I always like it, but some of them are used to
Was there a lot of seasickness then?
Yes, there was, yes.
But you don't seem to have...
I didn't, because I'd been to sea to a lesser degree before that.
Was that while you were in the fish trade?
Yeah, and that was just one of those people that has happened with quite a lot. The bigger the ship, the less I'm affected by the rock and roll effect. And
where were the vehicles put?
In the holds, separate holds.
Had they been winched aboard? Was there anything special about?
There was one or two flaps about submarines and once or twice. We had floating mines in rather close vicinity. We're lucky enough to avoid them all. And an escort and frigate, there were a couple of mines up one day, not so far from where we were. But it was fairly uneventful journey, actually.
Did you know exactly where you were going?
No, not till it wasn't disclosed to anybody until I think it was 12 hours to stay from the landing, you know.
They landed at Algiers,
yeah,
in mid-January. Or early January. What were your first impressions of Algiers?
Chaotic. Everybody, certainly foreign or everybody else, was consumed. The dots that we landed seemed completely chaotic. Nobody seemed to know what was happening anywhere. However, typical British fashion, we muddled through and finally got sorted out. But there were a tremendous lot of shipping there at the time, merchants and stores of various descriptions, and ammunition ships and God knows what.
So what about when you're actually ashore, the sort of sights, sounds and smells of Algiers? It was your first time abroad, wasn't it? Was it all strange to you? Or?
Well, we didn't have much chance to absorb that, anything there at that particular time, because we got our equipment that's sitting in there. Where we got this
eucalyptus camp, I think, was the first one.
Eucalyptus, yeah. Where we got an area called Fort Bellew. This place. It was a transit camp, actually, but we went there and then we went from there to the eucalyptus. About 23 kilometres, I think, on foot.
Well, you were marching as well.
Yeah.
That must have been a tough march.
Well, as I said, you know, I was pretty fit when I did a lot of running. I had a fair share of marching in the past for all of that. People got the impression that if you were in the MT, you never did MT on foot. That was quite wrong.
Now, what were you doing while you were at the camp? You stayed there about a week, I think.
Oh, just not doing very much at all, actually. Just routine maintenance on vehicles.
Were you equipped? When did you receive your new vehicles? You know, you'd only gone abroad with the bare necessities. When did you get your new ones?
Oh, I got them almost straight away, within a couple of days.
And what were they? What were you issued with? In other words, roughly what was your wartime establishment?
We got some chefs, 1500 of it, and Bedford. Certainly on the rear.
Anything else?
So I think
what about Jeeps and things like that?
We did get Jeeps, yes, we got the first Jeeps, I think we had.
What were the, looking at them, what were the 15-weight Chevrolets like as compared, say, with the 30?
Well, the Chevs were an improvement on the Fords and also an improvement on the Bedford.
What was so good about them?
Well, they were short wheelbase, but they were better vision and more powerful engines.
And what you said, there were 30 hundredweight Bedfords.
Yeah.
What were they like? And what about the Jeeps? Was that the first time you'd seen them?
First one, the first Willys Jeep.
Yeah. What was
the original Willys Jeep.
And what was your...
I thought they were great.
What was so good about them? Why was the Jeep such a success, do you think?
Well, it was such a versatile vehicle. It would go virtually anywhere. If you couldn't go in the Jeep, you couldn't go in anything. Or sand or wood or... upstairs or downstairs or whatever, you know, that's a huge range of gear. And
about how much could you carry in it?
Well, you couldn't carry a great deal. You could carry the driver and somebody else in the front, two in the back. A certain amount of equipment. Not a great deal. And later on, they used to use them to bring wounded in, and they had stretcher frames that were made adaptable and attached to the Jeep so that they could carry one at first and then adapt them to carry two, which was rather much. But,
How many Jeeps did you get? Well, the start.
To be quite frank, I think it worked out about one per company. So I think perhaps we've got six initially.
Anything else you were issued? Any other transport you had on your wartime establishment? You know, when you.
No. Well, the CEO had a Humber.
A car.
And he also got the Jeep, so he had a car and a Jeep.
And what about the bikes? Would you still have the bikes?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a variety, but the majority were Norton 500s. And we had a couple of BSAs.
So they hadn't changed. You same types of bikes as before.
Yeah.